Good afternoon. May it please the Court. My name is Colleen Shields, and I represent the appellant National Installment Insurance Services, Inc. I'd like to introduce co-counsel, out-of-state counsel Russell Kahn, and with the Court's permission, he will be arguing on behalf of our clients.
Good morning. Welcome to the Court.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Francis Murphy for Certain Underwriters at Lloyd's of London. I'll be making the argument for underwriters. With me in the courtroom is the lead counsel in the case, Robert Conlin of Walker, Wilcox, and Matusik in Chicago. He's been admitted pro hoc vici. He'll be making the argument for Dry Financial Services, Your Honor. Mr. Conlin has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal time. I wanted to alert the Court.
Thank you. Welcome to the Court.
Thank you so much.
Oh, Your Honor. Morning. Mr. Jones is also here. I should have introduced him.
Good morning. Welcome.
Your Honors, this is an insurance broker malpractice case against National Installment Insurance Services, Inc., or NIIS. We refer to it in short as NIS. NIS was owned by a gentleman named Robert Adams. NIS brokered a policy of vendor's single interest liability insurance, or in short, VSI insurance, for Drive with underwriters. This case involves two sets of misrepresentations by NIS. The trial court found that NIS made misrepresentations to underwriters, for example, that underwriters would be insuring a loan portfolio that consisted of 90% A loans, when in fact the loans were subprime. Not only did Mr. Adams make that misrepresentation, which caused underwriters to issue the policy, Mr. Adams even recommended the premium that underwriters ultimately charged for the policy. After the coverage was placed in London, NIS turned around and misrepresented the nature of the coverage to Drive. A cover note binding coverage was sent to NIS, and someone at NIS masked the limitations.
Mr. Murphy, as I understand it, the court found that NIIS had made misrepresentations both to Drive and to the Lloyd's Underwriting Syndicate and awarded damages. The appeal, as I understand it, is that the court erred by not awarding enough damages.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
So why don't we focus on the issues that relate to that?
Yes, Your Honor. I was trying to give the court background, and I will immediately proceed to my argument. I want to argue 2 points on behalf of underwriters, Your Honors. The first is that the trial court erred in several respects in its rulings on proximate cause. The second is that the trial court misapprehended and misapplied the law of joint and several liability. On the proximate cause point, the trial court agreed that NIS negligently misrepresented facts to Drive and underwriters, awarded underwriters attorney's fees and claims handling expenses, and found that they were proximately caused by NIS's misrepresentations, but denied recovery of brokerage commissions that underwriters had reimbursed to Drive. I wanted to say initially that we agree with NIS that this proximate cause issue is in part governed by a clearly erroneous standard to the extent that it involves questions of fact as determined by the trial court. We believe that the court erred in at least 2 significant respects on proximate cause. The first is that the court said that there was no proximate cause because underwriters were not required as a matter of law to return the entire premium. We think that the law did require that, and if we are right on that, that the law does require that, that we should prevail as a matter of law. And we think that issue is subject to de novo review.
But the problem that the vice chancellor had is that the this component of your client's damage claim, which I understand is in the $700,000 vicinity.
Yes, Your Honor, $783,000.
Includes premiums that never went to Lloyd's.
That it is, includes
their premiums that were paid to intermediate brokers. Do I have that wrong?
Yes, Your Honor, but from the time we filed the complaint until the time we settled, we took the position that we had to, in order to obtain rescission of the policy, we had to return the entire premium, and we could not leave the policyholder hanging out there attempting to recover monies against the brokers.
Well, I know you took that position, and I understand that you're taking it now, but the issue was whether you were required to repay those monies, when there were monies that your client never got in the first place.
Well, there's two points on that, Your Honor. One point is that we say we're required legally, but from a factual standpoint, if you look at it this way, we were involved in a lawsuit in the state of Texas facing a jury trial where the claims against us were over $7 million, and that included claims for punitive damages and attorney's fees and interest. So we have a $10-plus million claim against us in Texas. What the policyholder offered to do in light of the circumstances was to agree to rescind the policy if we would just return all the money to them. Under those circumstances, we weren't acting as a volunteer, Your Honor. I mean, we got out from under this policy, for which we might have had to pay $7 million if we lost the case in Texas, plus punitive damages and attorney's fees.
So you're saying that you agree that you were not legally obligated to return it. That it was in your interest to return the money, and as a practical matter, if you didn't, there would have been no rescission.
Both, Your Honor. I think we were legally obligated to do it to obtain rescission as a matter of law. That's part of the principle of rescission. But our underwriter testified to that fact, that was his understanding. We alleged it in the complaint. So from the time we filed the lawsuit, Drive understood that that's where we were coming from. But also factually, we were in a bind. How could we have refused to pay them the entire return premium and instead go to trial in a jury trial where we were facing potentially $10 million in damages? So my point is that no matter how you look at it, legally or factually, the court below erred. And it was clearly erroneous to say we paid as a volunteer when we were facing a very substantial liability far in excess of what we paid.
Thank you,
Your Honors. I've used up my time.
Yes, it went by quickly.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Robert Conlon. The central issue in Drive's appeal are who bears the burden of proof to establish the availability or the unavailability of alternative insurance coverage, and was that burden met? We fervently believe that NIIS had the burden to establish the unavailability of any alternative coverage, and that they failed to meet that burden. And so we believe we are entitled to stipulated damages in the amount of $4.529,780, that's $4,529,780, plus applicable prejudgment interest since the complaint was filed in August of 2002 when Drive filed the complaint. What makes this case so unique is that Drive established the liability against NIIS under Maryland law, going through trial. And the law of the case up to and through trial was Maryland law. And the case up to and through the filing of our initial opening post-trial briefs was Maryland law. And then at the end, to be told that we didn't prevail because we didn't establish liability under Texas law. That's what's so unique here. This is not a case of changing the rules in the middle of the game. This is a case of changing the rules at the closing buzzer. Maryland law places clearly under the Patterson case the burden on the insurance broker to establish as an affirmative defense that no form of BSI insurance coverage would have been available to Drive. And we think, I have five pieces of evidence from the record that we think overwhelmingly establishes that it was indeed available. First of all, NIIS, it's NIIS.
Well, excuse me.
Yes, sir.
I just want to make sure that we have the context of your arguments.
Yes, sir.
You haven't really addressed squarely the second opinion that the Vice Chancellor wrote, which does address this problem about applying Texas law after the fact. As I understand what the court did, said, well, whether or not it was erroneous for me to do that, even under Maryland law, I find that the burden the other side was supposed to meet, NIIS, was met.
Right.
Here. So
yeah, I can address that right away, Your Honor.
That's a mixed finding of fact and law, is it not?
Well, I think the applications of the facts to whether the burden of proof, you know, the actual facts and the facts they looked at is a finding of fact. But applying these facts to see if the burden was established or not, we think that's a de novo review for this court.
So you're now going to give us evidence that you contend as a matter of law requires us to reverse the finding made by the vice president.
Yes, sir. Because two things. First of all, the court, you are correct, said Texas law applies. And then initially correctly stated the burden there, which was the burden would be on the insured to establish that there was some policy that would cover the loss. He initially started to say that. And then he looked at Nice's attempt to make that a higher standard for the insured and say that, well, you have to show price and terms and exclusions. And the court beat that back and said, no, you don't have to do that. And there's no Texas case that says that. But that at the end of the day, we didn't prevail because we didn't establish these prices and
on re-argument. On re-argument, the vice chancellor said even if there was a replacement policy that could have been had, that is a policy that would have fulfilled the contract obligation had there been no misrepresentation, that policy was not available for this mix of paper. At a price that NIS would have paid.
Right. Two things. First of all, we think he misapplied what we had the burden of showing under Maryland law when he looked at that. Second of all, under the Seed versus Technicolor case, if looking at the facts, and I'll go to the five pieces of evidence here in a moment, if the facts are internally inconsistent or illogical, that those findings of fact are clear error, and we think that's what's happened here. First of all, NIS admitted
if there was a policy available,
mm-hmm.
But the price was one that NIS was not willing to pay. That, excuse me, is a finding of fact, is it not?
Yes.
Okay. So
we think he
that
is clear error.
That finding then? One that we would have to overturn in order to rule your way.
Well, yes. I mean, our position would be twofold. Number one, whether it's Texas law or Maryland law, we think we carried the burden of either we carried the burden to show that there was available coverage in some policy, and we think they didn't carry the burden under Maryland law to show that there was unavailability. Once you meet that, if the burden is established that there's coverage out there, and it's not a very high, we don't talk about price or anything like that. We then go to damages and to see what I think the judge did was conflate burden of proof and damages. And what he said was, because you didn't show that the price, you can't calculate with precision what your damages would have been. And they stipulated number 52 at A105 that drives total losses that would have been covered under the policy, had the policy remained in force, are $7.42 million. They stipulated that. Excuse me. And so starting with the burden of proof, if I may, first, because I think under Texas or Maryland law, the burden has been carried. And what it is, first of all, they admitted it. On cross-examination at trial, I asked Bob Adams, the principal of NIS, is VSI coverage available? And he said, yes, I would tell you that there could have been a policy available to drive, yes. That's an admission. They conceded in their post-trial brief that VSI coverage was available generally and that there may have been some types of VSI coverage available for subprime lenders such as drive, A447 in the record. The representations, number three, of Mr. Adams at a time when it unquestionably he knew that this was a subprime portfolio, he said, yes, I think I can get it at $80. That's what he told Drive. And then he was the one who recommended $80 to underwriters. And then he said he had a competing quote available. And we, this is evidence number four, we had a competing quote here that said they were willing to offer to drive at $80 per loan VSI coverage. And we also put up an expert that said there were four different carriers writing this coverage. So I think it's very clear that looking at all the evidence, and to the extent the court found, as a matter of fact, that it wasn't, I think it's clear error because of these inconsistencies. We have admissions and evidence supporting admissions that it was available. And
at what price?
Well, first of all, the burden doesn't require either Maryland or Texas does not require us to show it. And the court even said that in his opinion, Your Honor, that you don't have to show price. But if you want to go there, again, Adams and Mr. Hartman, both before there was any suggestion that there was $80 or that there was any suggestion that there was going to be prime, which there wasn't, he quoted at $80. And he was the one who set the price at $80. So I think, and we have the competing quote at $80. Not that we have to go there, but where that's important, and the public policy of creating the burden there is the because it's commercially really inefficient to require somebody going out to get coverage to have in his hip pocket an alternative policy with terms negotiated and price negotiated just in case your broker lies. You can say, well, here you go. Courts say you don't have to do that. Just show that it was available. We were deprived of the opportunity to go out and negotiate.
Does that rule make any commercial sense? If in fact NIS was told accurately that there is a policy available, but it's going to cost $200 rather than $80 for each piece of commercial paper, each account, then if NIS wasn't able to pay that, then NIS would go without insurance. But under the rule that you're arguing for, NIS gets a free ride. That is, even if it is a $200 per account policy, the damages ignore that.
No, not at all. Excellent question, but that's not our position. In the Groves case, what they focused in, that's a Texas case, they said the reason why the burden is just to show some availability as opposed to price and term is because it's the depriving the person of the opportunity. The person goes and thinks he has coverage and moves on with his merry life and operating his business, et cetera. And he's deprived of the opportunity not knowing that he really doesn't have a coverage because of misrepresentations. All he has to show to the court is, well, I could have gone out and gotten something. We were deprived of the opportunity. We didn't even know about this alternative coverage, which was being offered at $80, by the way, and not $200. The public policy is don't make the insured go out and try to prove price. And that's why both Texas and Maryland don't require that. Furthermore, the broker is the person of this equation that has the peculiar knowledge
be. Yes, there may be a windfall to the insured, but if there is a windfall, it's one that, as a matter of policy, ought to be paid for by the broker.
No, we don't think there's a windfall at all. We thought, Drive thought, that they had and they conducted their business on this mass portfolio of subprimes loan with the understanding that they would be protected if there was a default, if there was no primary, and if the collateral didn't cover it. They thought they were going to be protected by the policy that they thought they bought. So there is no windfall at all. The other part of your question that I'm getting around to here is that once you get to damages, both Maryland and Texas law state that you just have to the broker, if the burden is proved that there was availability of some policy, the broker has to step into the shoes of the insurer and assume the insurer's responsibility under the policy that he said he would give to them. Both Maryland and Texas say that. And in fact, the court cited that in his opinion granting summary judgment. It's, The Patterson case and the Lowett case and the Groves case, well, Patterson, Lowett's, Maryland, Groves, Burroughs, Scott, that's the Texas cases that just say you jump in the shoes of the insurer to avoid this whole issue here with good reason. It's a deterrent to a broker to say, I don't have to worry about it because there's no way these guys are going to be able to prove a price or terms, and I can just run away.
Mr. Conlon, you have less than 2 minutes that you reserve.
I will reserve. Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I do want to say that after 31 years of practice, I do consider it an honor and a privilege to appear before the Delaware Supreme Court. I have three brief points I'd like to make on both the Drive and the Lloyd case, but before I do that, I do want to say I have in my hands the 92 pages of the very thoughtful, thorough, and conscientious decision of the Vice Chancellor Parsons below that followed a lengthy summary judgment. He waded through the evidence very carefully. He waded through the law very carefully. He covered a lot of different issues, citing cases even that weren't in the briefs. And you got a very studied and conscientious look at these issues in those two decisions. On the Drive aspect to this, I would start out by pointing out that Vice Chancellor Parsons did apply a fairly generous standard to the issue of alternative insurance, and that is in A149-150 of the record. That's his first decision. And he does say, evoking the language of the Parsons case, which they rely on, that they don't need to prove a specific policy. They don't need to prove specific coverage. He applies a very generous and generic sort of burden of proof to them. Second of all, there's really a disconnect in their overall theme that they argue for Maryland law very vehemently, that Maryland should be applied because it's more favorable than Texas. Then when they get to Texas law, they argue that it's really, really very liberal, and all you need to do pretty much is show a misrepresentation, and they win. You don't have to show proximate cause. You don't have to show damages. They automatically win. And we would submit Texas law does not go that far. If you look at the two standard negligence proximate cause cases, which was Stinson and Belt that we cited, it's proximate cause substantial factor analysis, pretty basic. And they criticize Stinson, but if you shepherdize it, you'll see it's been cited widely and it continues to be good law in Texas. Then we get to their trilogy of cases that they seek to apply that are all statutory claims under their so-called Texas insurance unfair practices statute. In those cases are Royal Globe, Perkins, and Gross. And two of them are Texas Supreme Court cases. The third is the Texas Appellate Court cases. And if you read those carefully, they don't go as far as he says. And your Honor's question was right on the mark. Those cases don't say if we prove a misrepresentation, we automatically win. All three of those cases, first of all, were statutory cases. They weren't negligence cases as we have here. Second of all, they were all pretty straightforward types of insurance, fire insurance, homeowners insurance, and there was insurance, property and casualty insurance for a bar where there was a concern about vandalism. What we have here is much more sophisticated insurance. It's a product I personally had never heard of before I saw this case, the so-called VSI coverage, at $2-3 million in premium ultimately, completely different. There really wasn't much of a question in these other cases as to whether other homeowners insurance or fire insurance was available. That was a real issue here. Finally, as to these three Texas cases, in two of them, the insured had prevailed. So the Texas Supreme Court was looking at this in the context of, or the Texas Appellate Court was looking at this, okay, the insured won, and do we take this away on an extremely limited standard of review, what they call the no evidence rule? If there's any probative...
Excuse me, I'm trying to bring your argument about the Texas cases into some focus.
Okay.
Procedurally, isn't the only relevance of those cases in connection with the Vice Chancellor's ruling that he wasn't going to allow the Texas statutory claim into the case post-decision?
I would certainly accept that. That's not what's argued, though. What's argued in all of the briefs by my opponents here is that we should look at those Texas cases. And I just heard Mr. Conlon argue that there was a very low threshold of causation and damages under that case.
Why do we get to the Texas cases if there's a threshold issue, basically under Superior Court, Court of Chancery Rule 15, allowing amendments?
That's correct. I'm not arguing a motion to amend. I was trying to address Mr. Conlon's point when he talks about all of this evidence in the record, the five pieces of evidence that it shows that they met their burden. And what I meant to show with regard to the Texas cases is to rebut his assertion that you don't need to show other insurance. The existence of some coverage, as Vice Chancellor Parsons found, is relevant. And Your Honor pointed to the evidence about $200 a loan on this VSI loan. And that was actually the testimony. One of the five pieces of evidence he speaks to is the expert from Minota, Mr. Gilpin, who was an expert in this area. And they cite part of the testimony, but they don't cite the other part of the testimony, that for subprime it would have cost about $220 per loan. Obviously, when we're reviewing Judge Parsons' findings, some deference is owed under the case law, and that they do have to meet a clearly erroneous standard. And Vice Chancellor Parsons carefully went through all of that evidence. The admission that was cited as to Mr. Adams was cited out of context. Mr. Adams ultimately said that for this type of loan portfolio, a subprime loan portfolio, you could not find this coverage at this price. The $80 that was cited was for prime, not subprime. And Vice Chancellor Parsons made credibility findings about Mr. Adams' testimony on that point, and those credibility findings are not subject to review. The offer that was referred to that they had was thoroughly discussed by Vice Chancellor Parsons, and it was an offer for some completely different type of coverage. So what we say they're really asking is to basically read proximate cause and damages out of the law, whether it's Maryland or Texas, and we submit that neither jurisdiction goes that far. If I could turn to the Lloyd's part of this. Very early on, we fell into this nomenclature trap, I'd suggest, in this case, of saying it's a rescission, it's a rescission, it's a rescission, therefore certain things follow. But despite the nomenclature, I'd ask the court to consider several factors. Number one, this policy was in effect from February 1, 2001 to December 31, 2002, almost a full 2 years. Second of all, $1.3 million in claims were paid by Lloyd's under that policy. Third, and what we submit is a very important document, Exhibit 9, the settlement agreement. When Lloyd's and Dry settled their difference, if we look at page A63 in the record, paragraph 7, even in the settlement agreement, they weren't calling it a rescission. To the contrary, Drive was saying their position that they had advocated in court, which to that point in Texas was that the policy was valid, is not a waiver, modification, or retraction of Drive's position. So when they settled this case, when they settled their differences, this policy had been in place for a long time. So now they want to call it a rescission because they feel that helps them with the case law that says they need to get these commissions back. And as Your Honor pointed out, the case law does not compel Lloyd's to pay back to Drive the commissions that Drive's brokers earned. But the most important thing about this settlement agreement is this settlement agreement wasn't a rescission. They can call it a rescission. They can put that nomenclature on it. And they can even cite papers we've sign that say, well, it's substantially a rescission. They can hold us to that language, I suppose. But when you really strip away the name, the nomenclature, and look at this, what happened? Lloyd's bought a 50% interest in Dry's claims against us, which they say to you today is a $4.5 million claim. Now, you can read all the rescission cases you want. You can cite all of the rescission cases you want. But this one is sui generis. You will not find any case where the insurer pays money back to the insured and then takes a 50% interest, and it's in fact a greater than 50% interest when you do the math. They get the first monies back out of certain brokers, then they get $500,000 back, which they've characterized as a loan without a promissory note, without an interest rate, without any of the typical documentation of a loan. But they want to call this a rescission and say certain legal things flow from that, but those rescission cases don't really apply. Where is here? Lloyd's is standing up in this court looking to enforce a 50% interest in the professional liability claim against my client. And we say that that distinguishes this case from all of the other cases. Now, the vice chancellor below said they had the burden of proof, and they haven't challenged that on their damages. And what did they do to meet that burden of proof? Did they call anybody from Drive as to who settled, why they settled, how these numbers were arrived at? No. Did they call any of the lawyers who negotiated the deal and put this together? No. All of the totality of their evidence on this settlement won't even fill up one page of citation from the record. They had the Lloyd's underwriter come in and basically say it seemed like the right thing to do. And there's nothing in here about buying the 50% interest against NIAS or anything like that. And we would say that paltry evidence in the record that the vice chancellor properly found and correctly found that that did not meet their burden of proving that these payments, again, which were paid in part at least to get a 50% interest against my client, that these payments were proximately caused by anything NIAS did or didn't do. I have not used up all of my time, but I'm happy to sum up. And my summation is this. This case started out as an equity case in the Court of Chancery with legal claims appended to it. Ultimately, the Vice Chancellor correctly found that the rescission claim was mooted by the settlement, so the true equity claim had gone out of the case and that what he was left adjudicating was mostly legal claims. But in their brief at page 2, they talk about fairness and they talk about equity. And we would say it would be totally inequitable to award Drive damages that haven't been sustained, that were not proved to have been sustained, that were carefully reviewed by the Vice Chancellor and found on without, you know, Mr. Conlon talking about the five pieces of evidence, all of that evidence was thoroughly reviewed. It's been analyzed, and we discuss it in detail in our post-trial brief below. And it's discussed in detail in both Vice Chancellor's decisions. It's not even close that they prove proximate cause or damages. And even if the burden was on us, it's not even close that we proved that there was no proximate cause and was no damages. So it would be totally inequitable to give them, in effect, what Your Honor has suggested would be a windfall. This isn't punitive damages. It's not a criminal case. And they're not entitled to that. And by the same token, it would be totally inequitable to give Lloyd's a recovery when there's no evidence of the settlement, what went into that settlement, but that what we do know is that in that settlement, they basically paid money to get a claim against us that they've been enforcing in that action. We say that is inequitable as well, and that this court basically shouldn't enforce that agreement against us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just Vice Chancellor Parsons stated at page 45 of his opinion that Nice argues it is insufficient merely to show VSI coverage was available, reframing the issue as whether comparable VSI coverage was available at a price that Drive would have to place such coverage. And then further says, although it argued for the application of Texas law, Nice offers no Texas precedent for this position. That's because it's correct. Under either states, you don't have to show price. You have the burden, as I've already articulated, and once that burden is shown, you then step into the shoes. Price is absolutely irrelevant. Note that Nice is not even trying to prove its case under Maryland law, which, again, was the law of the case all the way through trial. Look at the evidence closely. An admission is pretty strong evidence, in my, as I'm sure the court is aware, and there's an evidence that meets the burden. It establishes the burden. There's evidence that when they step into the shoes, once that burden is met, that they stipulated to the damages. They said with precision to the penny, they agreed with us that if the policy that they said was in place was in place, the damages would be this. And they also stipulated to the premium. That's stipulation number 30. You do the quick math, that's how we get to our number. Again, on price, even though it's our strong, and even Vice Chancellor Parsons said you don't have to go there, don't forget that Nice was, Mr. Adams was the one who suggested $80, okay, when he was trying to get it initially. He was the one who suggested. The fact, I heard something about VSI coverage is really rare. Well, our expert, which testified, said there were four large companies writing it. I didn't see the red light. I apologize. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.
Thank you so much.